This neuroplasticity never stops, and the brain is always changing, Mark explained to me. This is why, he says, what I was told as a teenager about my brain was badly wrong. He told me that a doctor saying to a depressed person, now you've got a fucked up brain because it's different from a normal brain, makes no sense in the current context because we know brains are changing their wiring all the time. Physiology is always paralleling psychology. It just does. A brain scan is a snapshot of a moving picture, he says. You can take a snapshot of any moment in a football game. It doesn't tell you what's going to happen next or where the brain is going. The brain changes as you become depressed and anxious, and it changes again when you stop being depressed and anxious. It's always changing in response to signals from the world. When Mark was addicted, his brain would have looked very different from the way it does today. That just tells you that he's using it differently. When I told Mark that I'd been given antidepressants for 13 years, and had always been told that all my distress had been caused by a problem inside my brain, he said, "It's crazy. It's always related to your life and your personal circumstances." The seven social and psychological factors I've been investigating, Mark believes, have the capacity to physically change the brains of millions of people. If learning the map of London changes your brain, then being lonely or isolated or grossly materialistic, these things change your brain too. And crucially, reconnection can change it back. We've been thinking about it too simplistically, he says. You couldn't figure out the plot of Breaking Bad by dismantling your TV set. In the same way, you can't figure out the root of your pain by dismantling your brain. You have to look at the signals the TV or your brain is receiving to do that. Depression and anxiety are, he said, not like a tumor where something is growing in the brain because there's a real fuck-up in the tissue which precedes the psychological problems. It's not like that. They, the distress caused by the outside world and the changes in the brain, come together. But, Mark says, there's a crucial caveat to this. A way in which what happens in the brain does change the story for depressed or anxious people. Imagine you are subjected to some of the seven causes of depression or anxiety I've been discussing up to now. Once this process begins, it, like everything else that happens to us, causes real changes in the brain, and they can then acquire a momentum of their own that deepens the effects from the outside world. Imagine he told me that your marriage just broke up and you lost your job and you know what, your mother just had a stroke. It's pretty overwhelming. Because you're feeling intense pain for a long period, your brain will assume this is the state in which you're going to have to survive from now on. So it might start to shed the synapses that relate to the things that give you joy and pleasure and strengthen the synapses that relate to fear and despair. That's one reason why you could often start to feel that you've somehow become fixed in a state of depression or anxiety, even if the original causes of the pain seem to have passed. John Cacioppo, the scientist I spoke with, who had discovered how this effect works with loneliness, called this, I remembered, a snowballing effect. So, Mark said, while it's wrong to say the origin of these problems is solely within the brain, it would be equally wrong to say that the responses within the brain can't make it worse. They can. The pain caused by life going wrong can trigger a response that is so powerful that the brain tends to stay there in a pained response for a while until something pushes it out of that corner into a more flexible place. And if the world keeps causing you deep pain, of course you'll stay trapped there for a long time with the snowball growing. But telling depressed people that it was simply caused by their brains all along is to hand them a false map, he believes, one that won't be of any use in trying to figure out why they really feel this way or how to find their way back. It might in fact trap them. In his first and only inaugural address as president, John F. Kennedy famously said, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." Mark told me that if you want to understand how to think about the origins of depression and how they relate to the brain in a more truthful way than we've been taught to for the last few decades, it helps to know something the psychologist W.M. Mace said years ago, riffing on JFK. "Ask not what's inside your head," he said. "Ask what your head's inside of." There is one other physical cause of depression and anxiety that most people have heard about. My mother had periods of being seriously depressed before I was born and after. Both my grandmothers had periods of being depressed, although nobody used that word back then. So all those years I was taking antidepressants, insofar as I thought about depression as related to anything other than a brain malfunction, I had assumed I inherited it in my genes. I sometimes thought of depression as a lost twin born in the womb alongside me. As the years passed, I would often hear other people say this too. I was born with depression. One friend who'd gone through long bouts of being suicidal told me once on a long night when we sat up and I tried to talk to him about reasons to live. So I wanted to know, how much of depression is carried in your genes? As I researched this, I learned that scientists haven't identified a specific gene or set of genes for depression or anxiety, but we do know that there's a big genetic factor, and there's a quite simple way to test it. You take large groups of identical twins and large groups of non-identical twins, and you compare them. All twins are genetically similar, but identical twins are much more genetically similar. They come from the same egg, which splits in two. So if you find a higher rate of, say, red hair or addiction or obesity in identical twins than in non-identical twins, you know there's a larger genetic component. By looking at the degree of difference, scientists reckon you can figure out roughly how much can be put down to genes. This has been done with depression and anxiety. What the leading scientists found, according to the National Institutes of Health overview of the best twin research, is that for depression, 37% of it is inherited, while for severe anxiety, it's between 30 and 40%. To give you a comparison, how tall you are is 90% inherited. Whether you can speak English is 0% inherited. So the people who study the genetic basis for depression and anxiety have concluded that it's real, but it doesn't account for most of what's going on. There is, however, a twist here. A group of scientists led by a geneticist called Avshalom Kaspi did one of the most detailed studies of the genetics of depression ever conducted. For 25 years, his team followed 1,000 kids in New Zealand from being babies to adulthood. One of the things they were trying to figure out was which genes made you more vulnerable to depression. Years into their work, they found something striking. They discovered that having a variant of a gene called 5-HTT does relate to becoming depressed. Yet there was a catch. We're all born with a genetic inheritance, but your genes are activated by the environment. They can be switched on or off by what happens to you. And Avshalom discovered, as Professor Robert Sapolsky explains, that if you have a particular flavor of H5TT, you have a greatly increased risk of depression, but only in a certain environment. If you carried this gene, the study showed, you were more likely to become depressed, but only if you'd experienced a terribly stressful event or a great deal of childhood trauma. They didn't test for most of the other causes of depression I've been talking about here, such as loneliness, so we don't know if they also interact with genes in this way. If those bad things hadn't happened to you, even if you had the gene that related to depression, you were no more likely to become depressed than anyone else. So genes increase your sensitivity, sometimes significantly, but they aren't, in themselves, the cause. This means that if other genes work like 5-HTT, and it looks as if they do, then nobody is condemned to be depressed or anxious by their genes. Your genes can certainly make you more vulnerable, but they don't write your destiny. We all know how this works when it comes to weight. Some people find it really hard to put on weight. They can guzzle Big Macs and remain bone thin. But some other people, cough, cough, have only to eat one fun-sized Snickers for us to start looking like whales on Boxing Day. We all hate those skinny Big Mac munchers, but we also know that even if you're genetically more prone to put on weight, you still have to have loads of food in your environment for your genetic propensity to put on weight to kick in. Stranded in the rainforest or the desert with nothing to eat, you'll lose weight whatever your genetic inheritance is. Depression and anxiety, the current evidence suggests, are a bit like that. The genetic factors that contribute to depression and anxiety are very real, but they also need a trigger in your environment or your psychology. Your genes can then supercharge those factors, but they can't create them alone. But as I dug further, I realized I couldn't leave the question of the role played by brains and genes there. It used to be thought, as I explained earlier, that some depressions are caused by what happened to us in our lives, and then there's another, purer kind of depression that is caused by something going badly wrong in your brain. The first kind of depression was called reactive, and the second, purely internal kind, was called endogenous. So I wanted to know, is there some group of depressed people whose pain really is caused in just the way my doctor explained to me, by your brain wiring going wrong or some other innate flaw? If it exists, how common is it? The only proper scientific study of this I could track down was, as I mentioned earlier, by George Brown and Tyrrell Harris, the scientists who did that very first study into the social causes of depression with women in South London. They looked at people who'd been hospitalised for reactive depressions and compared them to people who'd been classified as having endogenous depressions. It turned out that their circumstances were exactly the same. They had an equal amount of things happen to them to trigger their despair. The distinction seemed, to them at that time, based on their evidence, to be meaningless. But that doesn't necessarily mean that endogenous depression doesn't exist. It might just mean that doctors weren't good at spotting the difference back then. There hasn't, so far as I can see, been any definitive research on this. So I asked many people involved in treating depressed patients if they believe endogenous depression, the kind caused just by a malfunctioning brain or body, is real. They disagreed with one another. Professor Joanna Moncrief told me she thinks it doesn't exist at all. Dr. David Healy told me it's a vanishingly small number of people, no more than 1 in 100 of the people who get labelled as depressed, maybe less. Dr. Saul Marmot told me it could be as many as 1 in 20 of the people who come to him with depression. But everyone agreed that if it exists at all, it's a tiny minority of depressed people. This means that telling all depressed people a story that focuses only on these physical causes is a bad idea, for reasons I'll come to in a minute. Yet, what about, I wanted to know, things like bipolar or manic depression? It seems like there is more of a physical component with them. Professor Joanna Moncrief said that this does seem to be correct, but it shouldn't be overstated. They are a very small proportion of depressed people, but with them, she says, I think the depression does have some biological component. A manic episode, she says, is a bit like taking lots of amphetamines, which leaves you with a low that's a bit like an amphetamine come down. But that shouldn't mislead us, she says. Even when there's a real biological component, as in these cases, it's certainly not the whole picture. And several studies have found that the social causes of depression and anxiety will still affect the depth and frequency of their depression. There are other situations where we know that a biological change can make you more vulnerable. People with glandular fever or underactive thyroids are significantly more likely to become depressed. It's foolish to deny there is a real biological component to depression and anxiety, and there may be other biological contributions we haven't identified yet, but it's equally foolish to say they are the only causes. So why do we cling so stubbornly to a story that focuses only on the brain or genes? As I interviewed more people about this, I could find 4 main reasons. 2 are very understandable, and 2 are unforgivable. Everybody reading this will know somebody who became depressed or anxious, yet seemingly had nothing to be unhappy about. It can be totally baffling. Someone who looks to you like they have every reason to be happy is suddenly in total despair. I've known lots of people like this. For example, I had an elderly friend who had a loving partner and a nice apartment and plenty of money and a bright red sports car. One day he started to feel profoundly sad, and within a few months he was begging his partner to kill him. It was so sudden and seemingly so unrelated to his life. It seemed that the cause must be physical. What else could explain it? I began to think about him and the many people like him differently only when I started by coincidence to read some of the early feminist classics from the 1960s. And I realised something. Picture a 1950s housewife living before modern feminism. She goes to her doctor to say there's something terribly wrong with her. She says something like, I have everything a woman could possibly want. I have a good husband who provides for me. I have a nice house with a picket fence. I have 2 healthy children. I have a car. I have nothing to be unhappy about. But look at me. I feel terrible. I must be broken inside. Please, can I have some Valium? The feminist classics talk a lot about women like this. There were millions of women saying things just like it, and the women meant what they said. They were sincere. Yet now, if we could go back in a time machine and talk to these women, what we'd say is, well, you had everything a woman could possibly want by the standards of the culture. You had nothing to be unhappy about by the standards of the culture. But we now know that the standards of the culture were wrong. Women need more than a house and a car and a husband and kids. They need equality and meaningful work and autonomy. You aren't broken, we'd tell them. The culture is. And if the standards of the culture were wrong then, I realised, they can be wrong now. You could have everything a person could possibly need by the standards of our culture. But these standards can badly misjudge what a human actually needs in order to have a good or even tolerable life. The culture can create a picture of what you need to be happy through all the junk values I'd been taught about that doesn't fit with what you actually need. I thought again about my elderly friend who was suddenly plunged into despair. He said he felt that nobody needed him or had any interest in an old man. He said his life from now on was going to be all about being ignored, and it was humiliating and he couldn't bear it. I wanted to see it as a brain malfunction, I realise now, because I didn't want to see what our culture was doing to him. I was like a doctor telling a 1950s housewife that the only reason a woman could be unhappy without work, without creativity and without control over her life was a defect in her brain or nerves. The second reason we cling to the idea these problems are caused only by our brains runs even deeper. For a long time, depressed and anxious people have been told their distress is not real, that it's just laziness or weakness or self-indulgence. I've been told this various times in my life. The right-wing British pundit Katie Hopkins recently said depression is the ultimate passport to self-obsession. Get a grip, people, and added that they should just go out for a run or get over their moaning. The way we've resisted this form of nastiness is to say that depression is a disease. You wouldn't hector a person with cancer to pull themselves together, so it's equally cruel to do it to somebody with the disease of depression or severe anxiety. The path away from stigma has been to explain patiently that this is a physical illness, like diabetes or cancer. So I was worried that if I told people the evidence that depression is not primarily caused by a problem in the brain or body, I'd be reopening the door to this jeering, "See, even you admit it's not a disease like cancer, so pull yourself together." We've come to believe that the only route out of stigma is to explain to people that this is a biological disease with purely biological causes. So, based on this positive motive, we've scrambled to find the biological effects and held them up as evidence to rebut the sneerers. This question troubled me for months. One day I was discussing it with the neuroscientist Mark Lewis, and he asked me why I assumed that telling people something is a disease would reduce the stigma surrounding it. Everybody knew, right from the start, that AIDS was a disease, he said. It didn't stop people with AIDS being horribly stigmatized. People with AIDS are still stigmatized, greatly stigmatized, he said. Nobody ever doubted leprosy was a disease, and lepers were persecuted for millennia. I'd never thought about that before, and it threw me. Does saying something is a disease really reduce stigma? Then I discovered that in 1997, a research team at Auburn University in Alabama had investigated this very question. The professor in charge, Sheila Mehta, who I later interviewed, set up an experiment to figure out whether saying that something is a disease makes people kinder to the sufferer or crueler. If you took part in her experiment, you were taken into a room where they explained that this was a test designed to look at how people learn new information, and they asked you to wait a little while they got it ready. As you waited, the person next to you started chatting with you. You didn't know this, but the person talking to you was in fact an actor. He would mention in passing that he had a mental illness, and he then said one of two things about it. He either said that it was a disease like any other, the result of his biochemistry not working properly, or he said it was because of things that had happened to him in his life, such as a disturbed childhood. You were then taken into a different room, and you were told the test was beginning now. You were taught how to push buttons in a complex pattern, and your job was then to teach that pattern to the other person in the experiment, the guy you don't realise is an actor. We want to figure out, the experimenters told you, how well people learn these things. And here's the catch. When the other person fails to get the button pushing pattern right, you should hit this big red button here, and that will give him an electric zap. It won't maim or kill him, but it will hurt. As the actor got the patterns wrong, you would give him a succession of little zaps. In reality, he was only pretending to be zapped, but you didn't know that. So far as you knew, you were hurting him. What Sheila and the other experimenters wanted to know was, would there be a difference between how many times and how hard the actor was zapped, depending on which reason he'd given for his depression? It turns out that you are more likely to hurt somebody if you believe their mental illness is the result of their biochemistry than if you believe it is the result of what happened to them in life. Believing depression was a disease didn't reduce hostility, in fact it increased it. This experiment, like so much of what I'd learned, hints at something. For a long time, we've been told there are only two ways of thinking about depression. Either it's a moral failing, a sign of weakness, or it's a brain disease. Neither has worked well in ending depression or in ending its stigma. But everything I've learned suggests there's a third option, to regard depression as largely a reaction to the way we're living. This way is better, Mark Lewis said, because if it's an innate biological disease, the most you can hope for from other people is sympathy, a sense that you, with your difference, deserve their big-hearted kindness. But if it's a response to how we live, you get something much richer, empathy, because it could happen to any of us. It's not some alien thing. It's a universal human source of vulnerability. The evidence suggests Mark is right. Looking at it this way makes people less cruel to themselves and to other people. The weird thing is that most of what I was learning should not in one sense have been controversial or new to anyone. As I described before, for decades, psychiatrists have, in their training, been taught something called the biopsychosocial model. They're shown that depression and anxiety have three kinds of causes: biological, psychological, and social. And yet, almost nobody I know has become depressed or severely anxious, was told this story by their doctor, and most were not offered help for anything except their brain chemistry. I wanted to understand why, so I went to Montreal to meet with Lawrence Kiermaier, the head of the Department of Social Psychiatry at McGill University, who's one of the most thoughtful people about these questions that I'd read anywhere. Things have changed in psychiatry, he said, and then he explained to me two more crucial reasons why we're only being told stories about our brains and our genes. Psychiatry has undergone a real constriction from this biopsychosocial approach. While some people still pay lip service to it, mainstream psychiatry has become very biological. He furrowed his brow. It's very problematic. We've ended up with a grossly oversimplified picture of depression that he said doesn't look at social factors. But at a deeper level for me, it doesn't look at basic human processes. One reason why is that it's much more politically challenging to say that so many people are feeling terrible because of how our societies now work. It fits much more with our system of neoliberal capitalism, he told me, to say, okay, we'll get you functioning more efficiently, but please don't start questioning because that's going to destabilize all sorts of things. This observation fits, he believes, with the other big key reason. He said, the pharmaceutical companies are major forces shaping a lot of psychiatry because it's this big, big business, billions of dollars. They pay the bills, so they largely set the agenda. And they obviously want our pain to be seen as a chemical problem with a chemical solution. The result is that we've ended up as a culture with a distorted sense of our own distress. He looked at me. The fact that, he said, the entire program of psychiatric research should look like this is really disturbing. Some months later, Dr. Rufus May, a British psychologist, told me that telling people their distress is due mostly or entirely to a biological malfunction has several dangerous effects on them. The first thing that happens when you're told this is you leave the person disempowered, he said, feeling they're not good enough because their brain's not good enough. The second thing is, he said, that it pitches us against parts of ourselves. It says there's a war taking place in your head. On one side, there are your feelings of distress caused by the malfunctions in your brain or genes. On the other side, there's the sane part of you. You can only hope to drug the enemy within into submission forever. But it does something even more profound than that. It tells you that your distress has no meaning. It's just defective tissue. But, Rufus said, I think we're distressed for good reasons. This, I realized, was the biggest division between the old story about depression and anxiety and the new story. The old story says our distress is fundamentally irrational, caused by faulty apparatus in our head. The new story says our distress is, however painful, in fact rational and sane. Rufus tells his patients when they come to him feeling deeply depressed or anxious, you're not crazy to feel so distressed, you're not broken, you're not defective. He sometimes quotes the Eastern philosopher Jiddu Krishnamurti, who explained, it is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a sick society. I thought a lot about this over the course of a year. It was hard to absorb, and I had to hear it from many directions and in many places before I fully understood. My job now was to give meaning to my pain, and perhaps to our pain. Part three, reconnection, or a different kind of antidepressant. Chapter 14, The Cow. Early in the 21st century, a South African psychiatrist named Dr. Derek Summerfield landed in Cambodia, in a stretch of countryside that looked like all the cliches of South Asia you've ever seen, peaceful rice paddies rippling onto the far horizon. Most people there were subsistence rice farmers, living as people had for centuries, but they had a problem. Every now and then, one of them would stand on a covered mound of earth, and an explosion would echo out across the paddies. Old landmines left behind by the US war in the 1960s and 1970s were still lying there all around them. Derek was there to learn about how this danger affects the mental health of the local Cambodians. In the course of researching this book, I went there too. By coincidence, not long before he arrived, antidepressants had begun to be marketed in Cambodia for the first time. But there was a problem for the companies trying to sell them. It turned out there was no obvious translation for the word antidepressant into the Khmer language. It was an idea that seemed to puzzle them. Derek tried to explain it. Depression is, he said, a profound sense of sadness that you can't shake off. The Cambodians thought about this carefully and said, yes, we do have some people like that. They gave an example. A farmer whose left leg was blown off by a landmine, who came to the doctors for medical help and got fitted with a new limb, but didn't recover. He felt constantly anxious about the future and was filled with despair. They then explained that they didn't need these newfangled antidepressants because they already had antidepressants for people like this in Cambodia. Derek was intrigued, so he asked them to explain more. When they realized this man was despondent, the doctors and his neighbors sat with him and talked through his life and his troubles. They realized that even with his new artificial limb, his old job, working in the rice paddies, was just too difficult, and he was constantly stressed and in physical pain, and that was making him just want to stop living and give up. So they had an idea. They believed that he would be perfectly capable of being a dairy farmer, and that would involve less painful walking on his false leg and fewer disturbing memories. So they bought him a cow. In the months and years that followed, his life changed. His depression, which had been profound, went away. You see, doctor, the cow was an analgesic and antidepressant, they told Derek. To them, an antidepressant wasn't about changing your brain chemistry, an idea that seemed bizarre to their culture. It was about the community, together, empowering the depressed person to change his life. When he reflected on it, Derek realized that this was true in his own psychiatric practice, back in a leading London hospital. He thought about the people he worked with there, and it hit him. When I make a difference, it's when I'm addressing their social situation, not what's between their ears, he told me later over a beer. This sounds strange to most of us in the Western world in an age of chemical antidepressants. We've been told depression is caused by a chemical imbalance, so the idea of a cow as an antidepressant seems almost like a joke. But here's the thing. That Cambodian farmer did cease to be depressed when his social circumstances were changed. This wasn't an individualistic solution. They weren't telling him the problem was all in his head and to pull up his socks or swallow a pill. It was a collective solution. He could never have gotten that cow on his own. The solution couldn't have come from him alone because he was too distressed, and anyway he didn't have the cash. Yet it did solve his problem, and that solved his despair. As I travelled in Southeast Asia meeting people in similar situations, and after I walked away from my long conversation with Derek, I began to ask myself for the first time, what if we'd just been defining antidepressants in the wrong way? We've thought of antidepressants solely as the pills we swallow once or more a day, but what if we started to think about antidepressants as something very different? What if changing the way we live, in specific, targeted, evidence-based ways, could be seen as an antidepressant too? What if what we need to do now is expand our idea of what an antidepressant is? Soon after, I discussed everything I'd learned with the clinical psychologist Dr. Lucy Johnston, who said she found a lot of it persuasive. Now, though, I had to answer a different question, she told me. How different would it be, she said, if when you went to your doctor, she diagnosed us with disconnection? What would happen then? Because we've been framing the problem incorrectly, we've been finding flawed solutions. If this is primarily a brain problem, it makes sense to look for answers primarily in the brain. But if this is to a more significant degree a problem with how we live, we need to look primarily for answers out here in our lives. Where, I wanted to know, could I begin? It seemed clear that if disconnection is the main driver of our depression and anxiety, we need to find ways to reconnect. So I travelled thousands of miles interviewing anyone who might understand this. I quickly discovered that this question has been studied even less than the causes of depression and anxiety. You could fill aircraft hangars with studies of what happens in the brain of a depressed person. You could fill an aircraft with the research that's been conducted into the social causes of depression and anxiety. And you could fill a toy airplane with the research into reconnection. But in time, I was able to discover seven kinds of reconnection that early evidence suggests can begin to heal depression and anxiety. I started to think of them as social or psychological antidepressants, in contrast to the chemical antidepressants we've been offered up to now. As I look back today on the seven solutions I've learned about, I'm conscious of two things, that they might seem too small, and at the same time they might seem impossibly large. In one sense, these seven forms of reconnection are only tentative first steps, because they're built on provisional early research. I want to stress that we are at the early stages of understanding them, and while there's evidence that they would start to deal with a great amount of the depression and anxiety we're experiencing, it's also true that they would only be a start. There would be much more to do even if we implemented all of them. But I think that if we look at them in detail, we might start to see an alternative direction of travel. They don't represent a program. They represent points on a compass. Yet in another sense, they will seem audacious because they require big changes in our personal lives and in our wider societies at a time when we've lost faith in our ability to make collective changes. I wondered at times, am I asking too much? But when I reflected on it, I realized that the audacity of the changes we need now doesn't tell you anything about me. It reveals only how deep this problem runs. If those changes seem big, that tells you only that the problem is big. But a big problem is not necessarily an insoluble problem. I want to be candid with you about how I felt while I was investigating this. When I put on my journalist's hat and quiz people, I found it fascinating. But when I would get back to my hotel room, there was often a jarring moment when I had to think about how it related to my own life. What these scientists were telling me in their different ways is that for all of my adult life, I've been looking for explanations for my depression and anxiety in the wrong places. I found this hurtful. Adjusting my mind so I could start to see the sources of pain they were telling me about was not easy. It was in this state of mind that I found myself in Berlin as winter began. I don't know quite why I went there. I sometimes wonder whether we're all drawn, in some unspoken way, to the places where our parents were happiest. My parents lived in West Berlin in the shadow of the wall, when it was a divided city and my brother was born there. Or maybe it was because several of my friends had moved to the German capital in the previous few years to escape London or New York in their attempt to find a sane way to live. A friend of mine, the writer Kate McNaughton, kept telling me on the phone that Berlin was a place where people like us, nudging beyond our mid-30s, worked less and lived more. Nobody she knew worked 9 to 5. It was a place where people could breathe in a way they couldn't in the pressure cooker cities where I lived. Berlin seemed to her like a long party with no bouncers and no entrance fee. Come and stay, she said. So I was awoken every morning by her flatmate's cat in an anonymous apartment in the anonymous Berlin district of Mitte. For weeks I wandered the city, talking to people aimlessly. I spent hours talking with elderly Berliners who had survived the near century in the city. To be an elderly Berliner is to have seen the world remade and ruined and remade again. An elderly woman named Regina Schrenker took me down to the bunker where she hid as a girl with her family and prayed to live. Another walked the route of the wall with me. And then one day, somebody told me a story about a place in Berlin and how it had changed his life. I went there the next day. I ended up staying there for a long time, interviewing dozens of people, and I kept coming back again and again over the next 3 years. It was, I think, the place that taught me how to begin to reconnect. Chapter 15. We Built This City. In the summer of 2011, in a concrete housing project in Berlin, a 63-year-old woman in a headscarf forced herself to climb up from her wheelchair to stick a notice in her window. It explained that she was being evicted from her home for being behind on her rent. And so, before the bailiffs came, in exactly 1 week's time, she was going to kill herself. She wasn't asking for help because she knew it wouldn't come. She just didn't want her death to happen without people knowing why. She told me later, I could feel I was at the end, that the end was coming. Nuria Cengiz barely knew her neighbours, and they barely knew her. The housing project where she lived was in a neighbourhood called Kotti, which is Berlin's Bronx, the place middle-class parents told their kids never to go at night. The housing project was like ones I've seen across the world from East London to West Baltimore, a big, anonymous place where people hurried to their doors and triple-locked them. Nuria's despair was just one signal out of many that this was no place to live. The project was awash in anxiety and antidepressants. Before long, some of the other residents started to knock on Nuria's door. They approached tentatively. Was she okay? Did she need any help? She was wary. I thought it was just fleeting interest, she said. I thought they saw me as a stupid woman in a headscarf. In the hallways and on the street outside Nuria's apartment, people who had scuttled past each other for years stopped and looked at each other. They had a good reason to understand where Nuria was coming from. All over Berlin, rents were rising, but people in this neighbourhood were facing especially steep increases because of a historical accident. When the Berlin Wall was built in a rush in 1961, cutting the city in half, the route of the wall was drawn pretty arbitrarily with some strange zigzags, and this area, Kotti, ended up being the part of West Berlin that jutted into East Berlin like a tooth. This meant that it was the front line. If the Soviets invaded, it would be taken first. So the neighbourhood was semi-demolished, and the only people who wanted to live in the wreckage were the people who were shunned by other Berliners. Turkish manual workers like Nuria, left-wing squatters and rebels, and gay people. As they moved into this half-abandoned place, the Turkish workers physically rebuilt Kotti, and the left-wing squatters and gay people prevented the Berlin authorities from knocking the whole place down and turning it into a highway. They saved the neighbourhood. But these groups have been glaring at each other with suspicion for years. They might have been united in their poverty, but they were divided in every other way. Then the wall came down, and suddenly Kotti wasn't the danger zone. It was prime real estate. It was as though one morning New Yorkers woke up and the South Bronx was in midtown Manhattan. In the space of 2 years, apartments being rented for 600 euros were going for 800 euros. Most people living on this housing project were spending more than half of their income on rent. As a result, there were some families left to survive on 200 euros a month between them. Many people were being forced to move out, leaving the only neighbourhood they'd ever known. So Nuria's sign stopped people on the housing project in their tracks, not just out of sympathy, but because they identified with her. In the months leading up to her decision to post the sign in her window, different people in the neighbourhood had been trying to find a way to express their own rage. This was the year of the Tahrir Square Revolution and soon the Occupy movement. And after watching the events flicker across the news, one of the neighbours had an idea. There was a big main street that runs past the housing project into the centre of the city. Some of the neighbours had already been gathering there on and off to protest about the rising rents already. What if, they wondered, we blocked the street with some chairs and some wood, and the residents who were being pushed out of the neighbourhood, including Nuria, came out of their apartments and went there? What if Nuria sat in the middle of it, in her big electric wheelchair, and we stood with her and said, we're not leaving until she gets to stay in her home? We'd get attention, the media would probably come, and maybe Nuria wouldn't kill herself. Most people were sceptical, but a small group of neighbours went to Nuria and proposed she come and sit with them in their little makeshift protest camp blocking the street. She thought they were a little bit crazy, but one Berlin morning, she went out and sat there, right by the main intersection. The sight of an elderly headscarf woman in a wheelchair in the middle of the street, next to some impromptu barricades, seemed peculiar, but the local media turned up on cue to find out what was happening. Very different neighbours started to tell their stories to the cameras. People talked about living on almost nothing, and of being afraid of being forced to move out to the suburbs, where there's a lot more prejudice against Turks, or left-wing rebels, or gay people. One of the Turkish women who'd been forced by poverty to leave her country 30 years before explained to me later, we lost the place we're from once, we cannot lose it twice. There's a Turkish saying, if the baby doesn't cry, it doesn't get the nipple. They said they had begun the protest because they thought it was the only thing that would make anyone listen. But soon after, the police came and said, okay, you've had your fun, it's time to take this down and go home. The neighbours explained that they hadn't been given an assurance that Nuria could stay in her home. And even more crucially, They now wanted an assurance that everyone's rent would be frozen. Sandy Kaltenhorn, whose parents were construction workers from Afghanistan, explains, "We built this city. We're not the scumbags of society. We have a right to the city because we built this neighbourhood. It wasn't the investors demanding higher rents who made the city livable," he said. "It's everybody." The neighbours suspected that in the night, the police would physically take away the chairs and the wood they'd erected. So they developed, spontaneously, a plan. Another woman who lived in Kotti, a woman named Tanya Gartner, happened to have a loud klaxon in her apartment. She went to fetch it. She explained that they should draw up a timetable to man the protest site. And if the police came, whoever was there could make a huge noise with the klaxon. Then everyone should come down from their apartments and stop them. In a scramble, people started to write down their names on a timetable to do shifts through the day and night to man the protest site in the street. You had no idea who you'd be paired with, only that it was a random neighbour you had never met. "I didn't think we'd make it for more than 3 days," remembers Uli Harman, one of the neighbours who was there that night. Almost everyone suspected the same. It was the middle of a freezing Berlin night, and Nuria was in the street, in her wheelchair. People were afraid to be outside in the dark in Kotti, but she says, "I thought, I've got nothing to do, I've got no money. If people want to kill me, then I'm dead, so I've got nothing to worry about." It looked as if the whole protest camp would fall apart right there, because people were being paired through the randomness of where they wrote their name with people they'd been suspicious of for a long time. Nuria was paired first with Tanya, a 46-year-old single mother with peroxided hair, a chest and arms covered with tattoos, and a miniskirt she wears even in a German winter. Standing next to each other, they looked like a comedy duo, the polar opposites of Berlin life, the religious Turkish immigrant and the German hipster. They sat together, manning the barricades. Tanya thought she knew everything about this neighbourhood, but watching it in the darkness, she started to see it differently. How silent it was at night, how the street lamps glowed dimly. At first, Tanya would tap away at her laptop awkwardly, but then, as the nights went on, they began to talk haltingly about their lives, and they discovered something. They had both come to Kotti as very young women, and they were both on the run. Nuria had grown up cooking her food on an open fire, because in the poor neighbourhood where she grew up, she had no electricity and no running water. When she was 17, she got married and started to have children. She was determined that her children would have a better life. So at the age of 17, she pretended to be several years older, so she could come to Kotti and work on a factory floor assembling parts. In the factory, she was raising money so she could send for her husband. But when she did send for him, she received a message from back home. He had died unexpectedly. Suddenly, Nuria realised she was alone in Germany, in her late teens, far from home, with two children to raise. She had to work relentlessly. When she left her shift at the factory, she went to clean, then she would go home to sleep for just a few hours, before waking up at dawn to deliver newspapers. Tanya first came to Kotti when she was 14 years old, she explained, after her mother threw her out. She didn't want to end up in a children's home, and she tells me, "I was always curious to go to Kreuzberg 36, Kotti, because her mother told her that if you go there, you'll get a knife in your back. This seemed to her impossibly exciting. When she arrived, she found, as she said, all the houses were looking more or less like after the Second World War. It was all empty and destroyed, so we started to occupy the houses in the shadow of the wall. It was only some people like me and some Turkish people who lived here before, in the rubbish houses they'd been given." When she went into the wrecked houses, she said, "Sometimes it was really spooky, because there was all the furniture, the place fully equipped, and the people were gone. So we thought, what happened here?" With a few of her friends, Tanya set up a commune, and they lived together collectively in the remains. She said, "We'd been punks at that time. We were political punks. In a lot of houses, we had our clubs and our bands there. It didn't cost anything, only 1, 2, 3 marks, so the band had a little bit, and the price for beer and other drinks was really cheap." After a few years, she realised she was pregnant and living in a squat. "For me, it was a very bad situation," she said. "Suddenly, I was alone with my son. I had nobody around to help me. It was a really strange situation." Tanya and Nuria had both been alone and single mothers, in a place they didn't know. On the day the wall came down, Tanya was pushing her baby son in a buggy when she saw a couple of East German punks crawling through a hole in the wall. where's the nearest record shop, they asked her. We want to buy punk records. She replied, there's one very near, but I don't think you have the money. They asked her the price, and when she told them, their faces fell. Tanya had almost no money at that time, but she opened her purse and gave them everything she had. Hey, people, she said, go buy a punk record. When Nuria heard Tanya speak like this, she thought to herself, it's another crazy one like me. She'd never told anyone before, but she confided to Tanya that her husband didn't die in Turkey because he had heart trouble, as she'd always said. He died of tuberculosis. I was always ashamed to say it, she said. It's a disease of poverty. He didn't have enough food. He didn't have medical care. That's one reason I came here. I thought he would get medical treatment and maybe I could bring him, but it was too late already. After Nuria and Tanya's hours on the night shift, next up was Mehmet Kavlak, a 17-year-old Turkish-German kid in baggy jeans. He listened to a lot of hip-hop and he was on the brink of being thrown out of school. Mehmet was paired with a retired white teacher named Detlev, who was an old-fashioned communist, and he told Mehmet grumpily, this is against all my beliefs. He regarded this kind of reformist politics trying to bring about gradual change as nonsense. But still, he was there. As the nights passed, Mehmet started to talk about his problems at school. After a while, Detlev suggested that he bring his schoolwork along so they could talk about it. As the weeks and then months passed, he became like a grandfather to me, Mehmet told me. His schoolwork started to improve, and the school stopped threatening to try to expel him. The umbrella that covered this little makeshift camp was donated by Zudblok, a gay cafe and club that had opened a few years before directly opposite the housing project. When it opened, some of the Turkish residents were outraged, and its windows were smashed in the night. I thought they shouldn't fucking open a gay cafe in my neighborhood, Mehmet told me. Richard Stein, a former nurse who opened the club, had a little pointed beard. He came here to Koti, he told me, in his early 20s, from a little village next to Cologne, and he too, like Nuria and Tanya, saw himself as a runaway. When you grow up in a little village in West Germany, he says, when you're a gay person, you have to leave. There was no other choice. When he first came here, to get to West Berlin, you had to travel along a narrow little highway surrounded by armed guards because, he said, West Berlin was this island in the communist sea and Koti was surrounded by the wall, so he saw it as a wrecked island within the wrecked island. The truest Berliner, he told me, is always from somewhere else. And this was his true Berlin. The first bar Ricard opened in the early 1990s was called Café Anal. The other name he considered was Gay Pig. They had transvestite nights, and in the years after the fall of the wall, where the world headed to Berlin to party in the new Wild West, their parties were regarded as some of the most hardcore in the city. So when Ricard came here to open Zudblok, he invited the neighbours to come to the cafe for coffee and cake, but they were wary, or worse. Some people would scowl at him. When Nuria's protest began, Ricard and everyone else at Zudblok provided the chairs and the umbrella, the drinks and the food, all for free. When Ricard proposed that the residents could meet whenever they wanted in Zudblok, they could hold all the planning meetings there, some of us were sceptical about it, Matthias Clausen, one of the residents, told me, because there are a lot of conservative people here. Sandy Kaltenhorn added, a lot of them were actually homophobic, so they were worried that people wouldn't come. But at the first meeting, there they were, albeit tentatively, all these old women in headscarves, these religious men, sitting with people in miniskirts in a gay club. There was nervousness on all sides. Some gay people were anxious about it too, thinking this would ruin the unity of the residents by pushing the Turkish protesters too far. But the need to fight the rent rises overcame even this concern, it seemed. Everybody made so many steps, Uli Kaltenborn remembers. Some of the more consciously left-wing residents, who had been involved in protests before, discovered something right away at these early meetings. We spoke literally different languages, Matthias Clausen told me. If they used the stock phrases of left-wing activism, the usual language that leftists speak among themselves, these ordinary people literally didn't know what they were talking about. They would just look back puzzled. So, Matthias says, we had to find a way to speak that everyone could understand. That forced us, me, to think about what I wanted to say, not to take refuge in some well-formulated phrases that in the end don't say anything at all. and it involved listening to people he'd never listened to before. Everyone agreed on a goal. The rents are too high and they need to fall. It was a moment when people were like, "We can't take it anymore," one of the residents told me. "We're here. We built this neighborhood and we don't want to move." Some of the construction workers who lived in Kotte suspected this was going to be a long fight, and so they felt they should turn a protest camp consisting of some chairs and umbrellas into a more permanent structure. They gave it walls and a roof. Somebody took a beautiful old samovar, the way to boil water for tea and other hot drinks that's popular in Turkey, from their apartment and gave it to the protesters. They named the camp Kotte & Co. Before, a handful of the residents on their own had contacted Berlin politicians to complain about the rent rises, but they had been snubbed or shrugged off. Now, people from all over the city were coming to see the protest, and the protesters were appearing on the front page of newspapers. Nuria was becoming a symbol, so politicians started to turn up, and they pledged to look into the question. People living in Kotte who'd been totally cut off before, scuttling from home to work, avoiding people's gaze, started making eye contact. Suddenly, you enter a space you wouldn't have entered before day by day, one of the residents, Sandy, told me. You have to listen more. We've met people who would never have met before. He found himself listening one night to two older men as they described what it was like to do military service in Turkey. He'd never thought about his neighbours' lives in this way. Nuria was amazed that people had responded to the sign in her window. "They seemed to like me. I don't really know why," she told me. "They always came and spent time with me." They decided, after a few months, that they had to step up their protests, and so they resolved to organise a march. Nuria had never been to a physical protest before, and she wanted to stay at the back. Tanya, in her miniskirt, told her this was nonsense. They were going to be at the very front, leading the march. And so there they were, leading the protest. People banged pots and pans, and as they walked through Kotte, people cheered them on the streets. From a window, a family had hung a banner. "We will all stay here," it said. The residents started to investigate why the rents were rising. They discovered that years before, back in the 1970s, a series of strange property deals had been made. At that time, people were abandoning West Berlin as a place to live, and the West German government knew that it would be a deep embarrassment for the West if the showroom for freedom in the middle of communism emptied out. So property developers were offered remarkably generous rents, guaranteed by the state for generations, in return for building on the front line. So once you factored in the rents that had been paid over the years, the protesters calculated the cost of building had already been paid off five times over. But here the residents were, having to pay more and more. Their protests continued as the months passed. Sometimes lots of people came, sometimes not many people came. One day, one of the most engaged residents, Uli Kaltenhorn, burst into tears at one of the meetings. She was exhausted. There had been so many night shifts and so much action, and nothing seemed to be changing with their rents. "You look so exhausted, you look so down," another one of the residents said. "We should stop it. We should stop the protests and go home. It's not worth it when you're so down." She concluded, "We have to stop this if this is the cost." We looked at each other, Uli remembers, to see what can we bear. About 3 months after the protest began, a man in his early 50s appeared one day at the Kotte & Co. protest site. His name was Tunkai. He had only a few teeth and a malformed palate that made it hard for him to speak. He'd clearly been homeless for a while. He started, without anyone asking, to tidy up the site. He asked if there was anything else he could volunteer to do. Tunkai hung around for a few days, fixing a few small things and carrying water from the gay club across the street to the protest camp, until Mehmet, the young hip-hop fan who was one of the people on the night shift, told him he was welcome to sleep overnight there. Over the next few weeks, Tunkai got talking to some of the most conservative Turkish residents who'd been staying away from the protest. They brought him clothes and food, and they started to stick around. Before long, the camp was being run during the day by local Turkish women, who'd often been confined to their homes alone for most of the time. They adored Tunkai. "We need you permanently," Mehmet told Tunkai one day, and they made him a bed, and everyone started to chip in to provide for Tunkai, until the gay bar across the street, Sublok, gave him a paid job. He became a key part of the camp. Whenever people were down, he would hug them. When they led marches, he'd be out in the front, blowing a whistle. Then one day, the police came to one of the protests. Tunkai hated people arguing, so when he thought they were, he walked up to one of the police officers and tried to hug him. They arrested him. That's when it was discovered that many months before Tunkai arrived at Koti & Co., he had escaped from a psychiatric institution where he had been detained for almost his entire adult life. The police took him back there. Psychiatric patients are distributed throughout Berlin's secure units according to the first letter of their surname, so he was sent to the opposite side of the city. He was locked in a room with no furniture that was empty except for a bed and a closed window. "It's always closed, because just outside is the guard," he told me. "It's always closed." He added, "The worst thing was the isolation. You're isolated from everything." Back at Koti & Co., people demanded to know where Tunkai was. The elderly Turkish women walked into Zublok and said to Richard Stein, the manager, "They took Tunkai. We have to bring him back. He belongs with us." The residents went to the police, and at first they weren't told anything. Eventually, they tracked Tunkai down to the psychiatric unit where he was being held. 30 of the people from Koti & Co. descended on it to explain they wanted Tunkai back. When they were told he had to be detained, they said, "That cannot be. Tunkai is not a person who should be put away. He needs to be out with us here." The camp turned itself into a Free Tunkai movement. They put together a petition to get him out, and they kept showing up at the facility in big groups to demand to see him and for him to come home with them. The place was surrounded with barbed wire, and the security to get in was like an airport. They said to the psychiatrists, "We all know him as he is, and we love him." The psychiatric authorities were baffled. They had never had a mass protest for a release. Sandy told me they never heard a story where somebody would be interested in one of their so-called clients. Uli added, "Our stubbornness, our refusal to believe this fucking system would take so long, made us push them." They learned that Tunkai had escaped 5 times before, and every time he was brought back and imprisoned. Nobody gave him any kind of chance, Sandy realized. It was a typical example of how a lot of people don't get any chance. Finally, after 8 weeks of protest, the psychiatric authorities agreed to release Tunkai if certain conditions could be met. He needed to have an apartment and a permanent paid position. Uli says, "Anyone who knows Tunkai knows those are the last things he would think of. What he needed was a sense of community he was attached to and he was useful for. He needed sense, a social sense, an aim he liked and he shared. They never saw that. But fine." Sublok confirmed he had a permanent job working with them, and an elderly man decided to move out of his apartment after his TV caught fire, so Tunkai was given his apartment, and the community moved in to renovate and decorate it to welcome him home. When I sat with Tunkai in the protest camp, he told me, "They gave me so much. They gave me clothes and warm food and a place to stay. When I was in the hospital, they made a petition. I don't know how to give all that back. It was incredible." Later, he said, "I'm incredibly happy with my family, Uli and Mehmet, and all the people who stand behind me. Just incredibly happy to be here and be over there at Cafe Sublok. That's the thing." Uli told me he was 53 years old, and it was the first time he found his home. Lots of the people who were drawn to the protests at Koti felt like that. Matthias Clausen, a student who'd lived in the housing project, told me, "Since I was a little kid, I moved once every 4 or 6 years, and I never felt at home like I do here. I never knew so many neighbours. It's very special. I never had something like this with any neighbour in my life, and few other people have." In the fight for lower rents, in the fight for Tunkai, the protesters were changing one another. The fact that the gay club had rallied to rescue this Turkish guy in need impressed all the Turkish neighbours. Mehmet, who'd been appalled by the gay club when it opened, told me, "When I got to know them, I realised everyone can do what they want to do. We get great support from Sublok. It's definitely changed me." And when it comes to the wider protests, he said, "The one person that surprised me most was myself. I realised what I could do, my own competence." When people remarked on how strange it was, this coalition of Muslims and gays, squatters and hijab wearers, the people at Koti would scoff. Nuria told me, "That's not my problem. That's the problem of people who think like that. That's not my issue. If somebody worries about Tanya's short skirts and my headscarf, that's not my issue. We think they match." She laughed. "If this isn't normal to you, see a psychologist. We're friends. I learned in my family and through my whole life, don't care for appearances. What matters is the inside. It wasn't a straight line towards greater tolerance. It had zigs and zags. Everybody should do what they want so long as they don't try to convert me, Nuria told me. I'm not sure how I'd react if my children said they were gay. I don't know. Sudblock offered to sponsor the Turkish teenage girls' soccer team. Their parents said it was a step too far to put the name